This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
I'm going to start by just issuing a disclaimer. I'm a journalist. I'm not an expert. I'm not an oracle. I'm an observer and occasionally an entertainer. And so don't expect too much, is all I can say. What I'm going to try to do is look at some of the work that's been done by greater thinkers than I and academics about the role of technology in the economy, use that as a framework, and then go on to offer some observations from some of the things I've written about and thought about. And I'm going to ask some questions such as, are all of our jobs going to be taken away by robots? I don't really know the answer, but I'm going to start with the steam engine. Steam engine invented by James Watt in 1763, or between 1763 and 1775, they were tinkering with it. And as you can see from that chart, in terms of productivity and impact on the economy, really very little happened. In 1830, the first UK intercity railroad, the Liverpool and Manchester Railroad, was opened. That led to the railway mania of the 1840s, but still not very much was happening in terms of actual labour productivity and impact on the economy. And then you get to 1830 to 50, you start to see really large impacts coming through the economy, and anybody who's read Dickens can see the sort of impact on London, the railway age. Things changed very rapidly. By the time you got to the late 19th century, the impact of the steam engine was becoming incredibly forceful. There's another way to look at the steam engine, which is that. And that's a chart taken from Brynjolfsson and McAfee's recent book about whether or not robots are going to take over the world. I'm afraid it's a bit indistinct, but basically what you can see, if you can just look through the blur, is human civilization, nothing much happens for about 2,000 years. The world's population is rather small. The steam engine is introduced. The Industrial Revolution takes off. Huge rise in global population, huge rise in human development that took place after that. And the other effects, not just the steam engine, clearly the Industrial Revolution, the invention of the London sewer system in 1865, Joseph Bazalgette, which allowed urbanisation as we know it today. So one lesson I take from that is that in the long run, if you look at it over that sort of perspective, things are moving very fast indeed around us. But over decades, of course, you might not notice technology in quite the same way. And decades matter to all of us in the room because that's the gap between our childhood and our adulthood. Another way to look at technology and the way that it gradually has an impact on the economy. This is taken from Carlota Perez, his work. And she drew this rough curve of the different phases of technology adoption and impact. And in phase one of any technology, you have early new products and industries. You have a very explosive growth and very fast innovations. I think of the invention of the powered flight in 1903 by the Wright brothers. And then there was a tremendous period of innovation, people trying out different sorts of aircraft, flying competitions, and a real sort of mania about what was in the public eye about what's happening. Until 1914, when the Wright brothers finally got their patents, managed to shut down a few of their competitors. And then gradually, however, the sort of impact of these technologies, such as airplanes, steam, electricity, starts to become more mature. You get the development of technology systems, industries, infrastructure. And then you go through to a period, phase three, where you're seeing an enormous impact across the economy. Now, let's just apply this briefly to past forms of technology. This, again, is from Carlotta Perez. And she's looked at these different forms of technology and the way in which they were invented. They created a financial frenzy, and then actually only later and after that they started to move through the economy and have big productivity impacts. And I don't know if you can see, but there in the Industrial Revolution, 1793, there was the canal mania. I didn't know about the canal mania, but clearly if you were investing in canals at the time, there was a lot of excitement. And there's various manias attached to different forms of technology, the railway mania, the railway stock mania, bearings, which I wrote about, the 1890 bearings crisis, connected to the expansion, the global expansion of steel, electricity, heavy engineering. So what that tells us, I guess, is that when we come to the fifth age, which is what Perez calls the age of information and telecommunications, we're only halfway through the game. She puts the internet bubble of 2000, the bubble and bust of 2000, as being the turning point before we're going to start seeing huge impacts across the economy. Another way of looking at that, by the way, is to look at Moore's law, which is the rule, as you know, that the function of microprocessors doubles each year. So there's a logarithmic advance in microprocessor speeds. They applied this to other forms of computer technology, microprocessors there, hard drives, residential internet download speeds, supercomputers. The important thing, of course, to note about that chart is it's a logarithmic chart. So those steady lines, or if you didn't have a logarithmic chart, would be describing a curve that went like that. They're doubling each year. And so, as McAfee and Brynjolfsson argue, the technology effects, the impacts on the economy, actually accelerate. There's a power law. Let's have a look at the expansion of the mobile internet. Here's a chart from Mary Meeker, the Morgan Stanley analyst, who's now a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And that shows, as you can see, steady growth in the adoption of mobile. But interestingly, of mobile phones, a growing proportion of what we call smartphones. In fact, I think that the very term smartphones is probably going away because we think of phones as being smart these days. And along the way, in terms of disruption, of course, that took down companies such as Nokia and BlackBerry, led to the enormous rise of Apple, and now Google with its Android system. But it tells us that there's an enormous increase in access for people around the world in access to mobile technology. And Mika has another chart looking at the spread of various information technologies. From the mainframe to the mini computer to the PC to the desktop internet to the mobile internet. And one of the things which is interesting about that chart is it shows that these technologies are gradually growing. She talks about the mobile internet possibly reaching 10 billion global units. That's rather more than the world's population, but I think some of us have more than one. And if you compare that figure of 10 billion to 1 million around mainframes in the 60s, there's an enormous increase in size and impact. And clearly, at the same time, what you're seeing is a democratization from corporations to individuals. Everybody carries a phone that's far more powerful than the old IBM mainframes. And that's bringing all kinds of new applications and possibilities for products. That's a rather familiar sight, I'm sure, to all of us, but I'm just going to pause on it for just a second and look at some of the applications on it. Top left, FaceTime. We now are used to the idea of free global video calls. That's rather unusual. If you go back 15 or 20 years, the idea of free telephone calls, never mind free video calls. There you have the Apple Maps application, the idea that you carry around geolocating device, which knows where you are, knows where you are and locates you within a map, tells you where to go. There's an application which isn't on there, actually, called Find My Friends. I prefer to think of it as Find My Daughters. They've reached a sort of exchange with me, which is that they are allowed not to reply to my text saying, where are you, providing that they allow me to track them. So we've reached a compromise, which suits us both. And it's very good for teenagers who don't communicate. Their phones communicate for them instead. And bottom right, there's an iBooks app. Again, just think of the impact of that and Kindle on the book publishing industry. The books have turned into e-books. Now, when we talk about disruption, what does disruption actually mean? I'm just going to go back briefly to the Clayton Christensen of Harvard's definition of disruptive innovation. And really, he talked about technologies which were cheaper and, frankly, good enough. They weren't. They didn't necessarily produce such good products as the industry that they're attacking, but they're good enough. They're cheaper, they're simpler, they're often smaller, they're more convenient. Christensen talks about the evolution of the disk drive in the steel industry. You could talk about the rise of mini mills, which produce steel out of scrap. And had enormous impact on the steel industry. If you think about, let's think about a disruption that's enabled by mobile technology and communications, Uber. So there we are. How do you hail a cab? Well, in the old days, you put your hand up in the street, cab stopped, you got into it, you relied upon the driver's skill and knowledge, because you had no idea where you were going, but hopefully the driver did. And knowledge, in the case of London cabs, with a capital K. At the end, you were in the right place, you paid the driver cash, got a receipt, got some change, you stepped out. Now, Uber replaces all of that, the entire thing, from start to finish. You don't have to hail the cab, you press a button on your mobile phone, the cab arrives, you can see the cab arriving, you know who the cab driver is. The payment settlement it takes place automatically. You rate each other. That's it. Now, Uber's been spreading very fast. It's 2010 that it started in San Francisco, and it's just launched in Amman in Jordan. Now, 2010 to 2015 isn't very long. London's one of Uber's fastest growing cities. And Uber presents a fundamental challenge in lots of ways to our traditional ideas of how companies work. Let's look at those challenges. This is the challenge it presents to its industry. There's an enormous regulatory challenge to taxis. Clearly, taxis, the traditional idea of a taxi was it was a highly regulated market with fixed prices that produced consistent supply of cabs. In return for those fixed prices, it drew cabs into the market. You knew what you were getting. But London only has 23,000 black cabs in a city of 8.3 million people. Uber's been able to sweep through a lot of minicab firms and increase supply by actually drawing in drivers. Now, in London, they have to be minicab drivers. If you go to Los Angeles, for example, they can just be anybody. But happily, in London, they are minicab drivers. And I'm thinking of my daughters again. It has a global reach, started in San Francisco. Now it's spread around the world. The software and the brand can spread enormously fast. The software takes the place of an entire layer of middle managers, taxi hailers. The technology becomes a platform, and the people who work for it are not really employees, they're contractors to the software platform. And you can see that model is clearly being applied to other industries. Airbnb has been trying to apply it to hotels and room rentals. LaundRap and others are applying it to cleaning your house and doing your laundry and so forth. But let's just think about the deeper effects of technology on other industries. I'm going to look briefly at three industries: transport, retailing, banking. And I'm going to start with an unusual car. That's the Google car. It's not really one of the best styled vehicles in the world, but it's self-driving, which makes up for it. Let's take a closer look at it. There's a laser sensor on the top, which scans like a radar scans around the vehicle. There's various sensors, and it can work out where it is, and it can drive up and down a freeway quite happily. It gets a little bit confused, a lot more issues and choices to be made in crowded urban environments, but it's getting there. Cars are getting cleverer quite fast. The average premium car these days, something like a Jaguar, has 100 microprocessors in it and 100 million lines of software code. I think some of us in this room can remember being able to open the bonnet of a car and work out roughly what was going on inside. Now, of course, clearly if we open the bonnet, we can't. And we certainly can't try and repair it. I remember the choke. I don't know how many people in this room can remember the choke. And the introduction of the automatic choke, which used to be very annoying because they never worked properly. And then it just disappeared, and now nobody remembers what they were. But I remember them. A lot of the technology is now being poured into fuel saving and powertrains. And in fact, the technology is moving away from making the driver feel good, things like styling and gadgets, and into the engine itself and into the brains of the car. And that's bringing a rise of three companies a lot of people really haven't thought about at all. When you talk about the car industry, they think about Ford Motors and companies such as Jaguar. But the companies which are equally important these days, Bosch, Continental, Delphi, they're the tier one suppliers. They're the people who actually make the technology inside the cars. This is a Boston Consulting Group chart, and it's rather complicated, so you don't need to look at much, except the point it is making that the blue line at the top, the tier one suppliers, the people who are making the core technology in cars rather than the car assemblers, have consistently been filing more patent applications than what we think of as the vehicle manufacturers, and that's growing faster. So actually more and more and more of the half of the car is going to a different set of companies, which is highly disruptive if you're Ford or General Motors. There's been an enormous acceleration of technology in the industry. But do we actually even need a car anyway? There's two cars parked on my street which are Zip cars. There's another car, there's a set of cars around the corner from Drive Now, which is a German drive sharing app. Again, it's an app, I can get it on my mobile phone, and I can rent a car as much as I want. And indeed, with Drive Now, I can take the car from the end of the street, drive it somewhere else in London, and leave it. I don't even have to drive it back again. So that makes us think about this very differently. A car might, in the future, a Google car might even turn up on your doorstep and take you shopping. Which takes us to shopping. Let's just think about a successful retailer, Tesco. Tesco had a number of things going for it, but one of the enormous breakthroughs it made, you could argue that it, as well as being a highly successful retailer, it was a very successful logistics and technology company. The invention of the Tesco Club Card in 1995 allowed it to segregate its customers, understand different customer segments much better than other supermarkets, understand how to discount. At its height, it was the supermarket you could go into, and there were essentially you could get value goods, you could get middle market goods, you could get premium goods, and it understood a lot of that through information technology. And at its peak in 2011, £1 in £7 was spent at Tesco. Unfortunately, it all then went wrong. It got overambitious, went global, underinvested, and it's faced a number of other issues, clearly, the rise of the discounters and so forth. And I think I'm told by the Financial Times, so I trust it, that on Wednesday it's going to announce a £5 billion loss. So it's clearly lost its way a bit. But one of the things it's now facing is the rise of online retail. Here's the e-commerce share of retail revenues in the United Kingdom, growing quite fast, estimated here that they'll rise to 18% by 2018. And who's the man behind a lot of this? Jeff Bezos. I always rather like that about that quote about Jeff Bezos, because describing him as mentally bold is certainly true. He's an enormously ambitious man who realised, I think, intellectually from early on the impact what technology could do to the retailing industry, and placed a series of increasing bets on that. So far, he's been successful. If you look at Amazon's rise, it actually has a higher share of the e-book market in the UK than it does in the US. Hachette said during its negotiations with Amazon that 78% of Hachette e-books come through the Kindle. You pay £79, as I've done, and you can various people turn up on bikes and deliver things to you all the time. Obviously, it's going to stores. They have an extraordinary network of logistics, warehouses, motorcycle couriers. They also, by the way, in the warehouses have people called pickers, and they are people who work in the warehouses taking stuff off shelves, putting it in carts, which then gets wrapped or put into a cardboard box and sent to me. Those people called pickers are guided by devices which tell them exactly where to go, and they're basically, as one Amazon executive described it to the Financial Times, it was sort of like a robot but in human form. It's human automation, if you like. Well, and on that worrying note about human robots, let's think about bankers. That is a Texas Instruments calculator. I put it up because it's a piece of solid evidence of one of the cleverest ideas yet come up with in banking and finance. Fisher Black and Myron Scholes, who in 1973 invented option pricing and the Black-Scholes model, which allowed options and derivatives to be valued correctly for the first time. And Texas Instruments, a year later, produced something that looked a little bit like that, which I knew Wall Street traders could plug the Black-Scholes model into it and come up with the correct value for options. That, of course, eventually led to the rise of credit derivatives in the 1990s, collateralized debt obligations, an enormous amount of financial speculation, and the financial crash. So let's move on to another clever financial idea. That's Bitcoin. This is taken from the paper, the original 2008 paper on Bitcoin and the blockchain, which is the core technology of Bitcoin, or how it's supposed to work, by Satoshi Nakamoto, who is an anonymous individual that nobody's discovered who he is, but he's clearly very clever. And it replaces the central ledger of payments with some form of peer-to-peer mechanism. And Bitcoin was supposed to be structured in a way so that the currency was limited. It could not be inflated away by central bankers, and it had stable value. That was the idea. Let's look at the price of Bitcoin. Well, if you bought at the bottom, you'd still be doing fine, but if you bought when people were talking about it the most, like all financial bubbles around January last year, then you're not doing so well. That doesn't mean, that, by the way, that Bitcoin and the technology underlying it is a bad idea, because the blockchain itself actually potentially solves lots of problems of online identity, contracts. One of the difficulties of the music industry, for example, was that there was no such thing as identifying an individual MP3. They could be copied thousands of times. If you had a contract embedded in the MP3, you couldn't copy it. But we'll have to wait for some of those improvements. Meanwhile, some of you may have noticed that around London and San Francisco and New York, there's an enormous rise of what are called fintech companies. Companies such as TransferWise, some of these others, that are challenging banks and trying to provide services that are traditionally provided only by banks, often on a peer-to-peer basis. Lending Club, which has had its IPO in the States, is a peer-to-peer lender. You can contribute money to it, and it lends it out to people. It tries to assess their risk, rather like a bank. But instead of the bank collecting the money and then being the intermediary, it's essentially a marketplace. RateSetter in the UK is like that. A lot of these companies, including TransferWise, actually, they're trying to attack, quite rightly, I think, the services for which the banks charge a premium. So, for example, TransferWise is a peer-to-peer foreign exchange service where you can, if you want to exchange your money into euros and somebody else wants to exchange their money's euros into sterling, it swaps the two. It's like a market where the two of you meet, but you meet at the mid-price instead of having the bank spread. The question to me is whether or not in financial services and in fintech, a lot of these services will really try to attack the core of financial services, which is highly regulated and not very profitable, or simply pick off the profitable bits around the outside. I suspect they might try and do the latter. But what it does tell you more broadly is that disruption is fun. And what I mean by that is I'll say three sentences to you. My teenager is disruptive. My neighbour is disruptive. My company is disruptive. Now, the first two don't sound very fun, do they? But the last one is fun. As Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple, said, it is more fun to be a pirate than to join the Navy. And by fun, he didn't just mean it was a laugh. He meant that you could actually have an enormous impact on established companies through technology. And Jobs himself created what is now the world's most valuable company. He started with venture capital funding, extremely iconoclastic, built on technology of the melding of hardware, software and services in new ways. And this quote from Maurice Levy of Publicis is the fear that I think a lot of established companies now have, which is that Uber, Apple, technology companies are going to replace them or attack them or take away the most profitable parts of their market. The average length of time a company stayed in the S&P 500 in 1958 was 61 years. There's only one left, by the way, it's General Electric. That figure by 2012 had fallen to 18. So in other words, the rate at which companies are rising and falling is speeding up. And technology, we're seeing, can change industries very rapidly. There's an idea which a Silicon Valley venture capitalist has of what he calls a full stack startup. I won't really go into the lingo, but what it means is that a technology company like Uber and others used to create a technology and then try to sell it to a large company or and then get the royalty fees. Now they've realized that actually once you've got the core technology, the other bits like customer service, billing, marketing can be added around the outside and that can become a company. And with lower trade barriers, less regulation, those companies can spread across the world. And that's having enormous disruptive impacts and a lot of regulators, a lot of people are getting worried about it. And I think the current EU investigation of Google's power in Europe is one piece of evidence of that. But never mind companies. What about us? Now, I'll give you a clue as to what journalists feel like these days. This is a quote from a man who used to ply a ferry across the Thames in the 17th century when they invented the Hackney cab. They have undone my poor trade, whereof I am a member. That's what technology does. Something comes along and then the job you had, which you thought was safe, isn't safe any longer. Even Queen Elizabeth worried about it. This is what she said to the inventor of the stocking frame knitting machine in 1589, and he wanted a patent. And he came along and applied to a patent, and she said, well, if I gave you a patent on this machine, it would destroy employment. People have always feared that, clearly, and Keynes, in 1933, thought that technology would inevitably overtake the ability of job creation in societies, and we'd be faced with an age of leisure. It hasn't actually happened yet. In fact, most people seem to be working harder and harder, but This is a chart, and it will be impossible to read exactly what it says, but I'll give you the thrust of it. It's a chart drawn up by Freyan Osborne in a work in 2013, where they estimated that 47% of current jobs were at risk in some form or other from technology. You can see that if you're in management, business and financial, things aren't as bad as they are for other professions such as education, legal, community service, arts and the media. But there's still not that great, actually. If you look at the left-hand side, there's still an enormous number of jobs at risk. And whether or not our jobs are individually at risk, I think what we're seeing is that management as a profession is becoming automated. There's an enormous number of management and coordination tasks that can be done by technology now. Labour markets are becoming more like stock markets, where people meet in the middle and bid for services. There's been a huge expansion of potential supply in labour markets. Uber is an example of that. And in some ways, I sometimes feel that technology is acting rather like the breaking down of global trade barriers, where an enormous number of people in China came onto the labour market, the global labour market, at the same time, and had hugely disruptive impacts. I just wonder whether technology is going to have a similar sort of impact within economies. I don't know the answer, but I'm going to conclude by saying that technology does mean that all kinds of companies are under attack in all sorts of different industries. And we're used to thinking of technology as being a matter of the technology industry, but what we're seeing is really obvious spread into many different industries. The company itself is under attack, and by that I mean we're used to the idea of risk being gradually transferred from the company, lifetime employment, defined benefit, pension schemes, to individuals. We've seen that in the post-war era, that old bargain has been broken. But increasingly, the company itself, the idea that you needed a cohesive corporation in the middle to act as a coordinating mechanism, is being attacked and being replaced by markets in a lot of things. Regulating for technology, i.e. deciding what you should do about this stuff and how you should try to protect legitimate social interests without blocking technology and productivity, is an extremely difficult thing to do. Average intelligence may not be enough anymore. The sort of jobs which are safer, are those with relatively high education and highly paid jobs. But actually, if you're in the middle, it's not looking that great anymore. And then finally, the apocryphal Chinese curse, although it isn't one. We live in interesting times. Thank you very much.